Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm really excited to be here with all of you today. I have a great show. Andrew Faust, who is a wonderful permaculturist and founder of the Center for Bioregional Living, will be joining me in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you things that are going on in and around the news, ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, I just want to let you all know that this is National CSA Week. And if you don't know what CSA stands for yet, that stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And Community Supported Agriculture is the best way for everyone to get local seasonal vegetables, next to growing your own, that is. Organic vegetables in season, and support the farmer. You're going to be buying directly from the farmer if you have a CSA share. And the way community supported agriculture works is you actually purchase a share ahead of time at the beginning of the season when the farmer can really use the funds to purchase seeds and any type of inputs they need for their soil. So giving the farmer the money up front is really helpful to them. And then what happens is the rest of the summer or season, you get a box of that week's harvested vegetables throughout the season. And it's really a wonderful way to also connect with your local community, with other people that care about getting good quality food as well. But every CSA is slightly different. You know, some CSAs only share the vegetables that they grow, where other CSAs also bring in eggs from local farmers or grass-fed meat from local farmers. Some have flowers, some have cheese, dairy, bread. You know, so there's so many different models of CSAs. Some CSAs, you need to pick up your share at the farm. Other CSAs have drop-off points, like a lot of the East End farms here on Long Island drive to the green market in the city in Union Square. So, you know, you have to find the CSA that's right for you. And so I have partnered with Slow Food North Shore and NOFA New York. NOFA New York stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Together, we are organizing a Long Island CSA fair here in New York, and it will take place at the Sisters of St. Joseph's on Saturday, March 13th, which is coming up. It's just like 2 weeks away. We have a rain date of Sunday, March 14th, but we are setting it up outdoors like a farmer's market. So all of the farms will be represented there with a pop-up tent and a table so you can actually talk to the farmers. You can find out what their program offers, where their drop-offs or pickups are, whether you need to pay the whole amount up front at the beginning of the season or whether you can make payments. You know, every farm is a little different, as I said. So at our CSA fair, in addition to the farmers, we've arranged for the Green Street food truck to be there and Mife's knife sharpening truck. So you can bring your knives, since we've all been doing so much cooking over the season. If you don't know how to sharpen your knives, it's really wonderful to bring them all to this truck and have him sharpen them for you. And we've also arranged for live music. So we do hope that you will be able to join us at the Long Island CSA Fair, and we're really excited about that. And I want to share with you some things that are in the news that you want to know about. If you are a person of color, Black, Indigenous, person who is interested in farming, the Rodale Institute has partnered with the Organic Farmers Association, and they're launching a new organic farmer micro grant program for people of color. And this is a great opportunity. Applications are open now, but we're really trying to support farmers who are either already organic or transitioning to organic or aspiring to be an organic farmer. And this is a really wonderful program to help finance that effort. So I have all that information on my website if you're interested. There is also support needed for the first New York Offshore Wind Farm, and that is being organized by the Citizens Campaign for the Environment. And the wind farm would take the place of having to build another another fossil fuel power plant out on the island. And we know how that went before with the power plant in Shoreham that they tried to build and ended up closing it. And we are still paying, those of us on Long Island are still paying the LIPA bills for that mishap. But anyway, this would be a wind farm out on the South Fork of Long Island. And, you know, right now on the South Fork of Long Island, there's a big increase in energy demand, especially now with COVID, with so many people who have left the city and have moved out to their homes out on the island year round. The island needs more energy. And so either they need to create it with an offshore wind farm or a new fossil fuel plant. And we know we don't want to go the way of the fossil fuel plant. So we need to support this wind farm. And they are looking for people to speak out and let their comments be known. So again, on my website, there are links to let the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management know that we are in support of the South Fork Wind Farm. So please, you know, please participate in that. And then ways that you can take action. Also, there's a bill to support the city council speaker, or to push the city council speaker, Corey Johnson, to support a bill that requires people to ask if they want a plastic straw, that when restaurants serve a drink, they don't automatically serve a plastic straw with it. Right now, Americans use more than 500 million plastic straws each day. We use more than 100 billion plastic bags each year. And plastic is just a huge problem. They're actually saying that the average American now eats and ingests a credit card worth of plastic every week. And I know that's hard to believe, but, you know, the plastic breaks down into these micro beads and, you know, gets into our water, it gets into our food, the fish eat it, and then we ingest it. And so it is really becoming a big problem. So we want to reduce plastic. A wonderful organization called Beyond Plastic has lots of ways that you can take action. They actually have developed some sample bills that you can try to pass in your local towns and cities. And if you want to, even in your state, Vermont and New Jersey have recently passed similar laws that will reduce the plastic use. So there's ways that we can take action. And as I say so often, it's impossible for us all to do everything. We are plagued with so many problems in this, in our society right now, between food, our environment, racial inequality, so many. So we need to pick our battles, but everyone can take on something. There's just so many issues that need to be covered, and it's really important that everybody does something to make our world a better place. So please check out my website. If you do not get my newsletter, you can sign up for my newsletter on my website at iegreen.com. And now I want to share with you this week's recipe. It's vegetable creole, and it's I didn't make it too spicy, but you can always up the hot sauce or the Tabasco if you'd like it to be a little bit more spicy. Everyone's different, and so often I'm cooking for people that, you know, have to limit the amount of spice that they ingest. So anyway, this vegetable creole, first I'm going to tell you the ingredients that you need. You need some olive oil. I used about a tablespoon, that's all. I'm trying to use less and less oil in my cooking. One small onion chopped, 2 tablespoons minced garlic, 2 carrots chopped small, 2 celery chopped, 2 portobello mushrooms cubed, 1 pepper diced. I used half a yellow and half an orange just to make it colorful. 2 tablespoons of Creole seasoning, and there's lots of different ones out there. You can either make your own, you can find many recipes online, or you can buy already made up Creole seasoning. 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1 can of Eden organic chickpeas, and 1 can of Eden organic black beans. And those are the smaller cans, the 15-ounce size. 1 teaspoon of black pepper, 1 teaspoon of smoked paprika, 1 teaspoon of white pepper, 1 teaspoon of thyme, 2 tablespoons of tamari, 1 tablespoon of a vegan Worcestershire sauce, 1 tablespoon of hot sauce or Tabasco, 1/2 cup of white wine, 1 large can fire roasted tomatoes, 1 bunch of collard greens, and that was, you know, anywhere between 5 to 6 cups chopped. And for the collard greens, I first removed the ribs, the hard ribs, and then I just chopped up the leaves. 2 cups of frozen corn. I actually got the fire roasted corn. If you could get that, the fire roasted frozen corn is delicious. 3 bay leaves, 1/4 cup of chopped parsley, and 1 teaspoon of salt. And then I sauteed the onions and carrots in the olive oil with the garlic for about 5 minutes. And I did all of this in my wok, but you can use any heavy duty cast iron frying pan or saucepan that you have. I added the peppers, the celery, the mushrooms, and the Creole spice and cooked that for a little bit. Added the tomato paste and continued cooking until the tomato paste started to brown a bit and really become aromatic. Then I added the chickpeas and the black beans, along with the smoked paprika, the thyme, the Worcestershire sauce, the tamari, the white and black pepper, and the hot sauce. Then I added the wine and cooked that down for about 5 minutes. Then I added the fire-roasted tomatoes, the salt, the bay leaf, the collard greens, and the corn. I covered that and let that reduce for about 10 minutes until all the flavors come together. And you can stir it, you know, while you have it, you can cover it and, you know, pick up the cover and give it a stir every now and then. But let all those flavors come together. I added the chopped parsley at the end. Taste it and see if you want a little more spice. If you like a little more smoked flavor, you can add a little more of the smoked paprika. You can add a little bit more of the hot sauce if you want a little bit more spice. And also you can add a little more salt if you'd like that. And that is it. It cooks up really fast. It's so delicious. So of course, if you make it, please share it because I'd love to hear how everybody likes it. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you this week's guest, Andrew Faust. He is a premier permaculture teacher and designer of North America, and he's been doing it for over 2 decades. His passionate mind-expanding talks and curriculum have been motivating teachers, and he has a great TEDx talk that you can find online. His curriculum have been motivating teachers as well as students. He had a long career as a high school teacher in an open community free school in Glenmore, Pennsylvania. And he did that for a long time. And then in 1999, he developed his own permaculture PhD project, a fully off the grid straw bale educational center in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. He moved to Brooklyn in 2007, where he's been applying his knowledge to the urban landscape. And Andrew's been inspiring filmmakers to take up permaculture. And the film Inhabit stars Andrew a lot. And it's a great film if you haven't seen it. His permaculture design certification course has over 500 graduates so far. And he and his wife, along with their daughter, run the Center for Bioregional Living in Ellenville, New York. Andrew is a visionary permaculturist and a bioregional educator, and he taps into the synergy between permaculture and biodynamic agriculture, which I'm looking forward to talking to him about. I've done a little bit of studying of biodynamics myself as a Waldorf teacher, and seeing where those come together is really interesting to me as well. Mm-hmm. So it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Andrew. Andrew, you with me now?
I am, Bhavani. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Great. So I wanted to just, start by hearing a little bit about your story, your history. How did you come to permaculture?
Well, most people who have been attracted to this discipline have a lineage that we hearken from, so to speak. And that's always a good starting point for telling the story of why permaculture from the perspective of my life personally, but also clearly it's also symbolic of, I think, a lot of our lives when you think about what is the journey that we've been on to come to an understanding of what are compelling solutions and how did you arrive at those solutions. And well, permaculture might not be the most exciting sounding term phonetically, it ends up being actually quite an inspiring set of ideas that are associated with it. And my teachers, I studied at the farm in Tennessee, which is one of the larger old hippie communes started in the United States by Stephen Gaskin, Ina Mae Gaskin. Ina Mae, arguably more well known than Stephen, even though Stephen is who the hippies in their school buses followed to live with in Summertown, Tennessee on 1600 acres. They had about 1200 hippies living there.
And yeah, Ina Mae inspired my sister to go become a midwife. So yeah, familiar with that.
You know, fast forward, our daughter is home birthed at home, and that was a major home birthed at home. A bit of a redundancy there. So that's something that's near and dear to me as well. And I also certainly understand that not all women feel safe or comfortable or like that's a good choice. And I support all the choices that are available. But I do think we have to acknowledge we live in a society that has underappreciated the safety and quality of life that goes along with home birthing. So Ina Mae Gaskin has been one of those voices of reason in a culture that has been dominated by Western surgical medical approaches to birth. The beginning of life and the end of life. In fact, our design assignment for my design class there in 1996 was to design a combination old folks home and birthing center that Stephen and Ina Mae wanted to start on 200 acres they had bought adjacent to the farm on a property they called Rosinante. So our design class was taught by Peter Bain, Chuck Marsh, Chuck died of cancer, Toby Hemingway has died of cancer. Cancer is part of my life legacy. My dad died of cancer when I was graduating from college. So I also, on that note, I brought even back when I first took my class with Peter and Chuck and Patricia Allison, and those folks hadn't started Earth Haven yet, which is a permaculture-informed eco-village outside of Asheville, North Carolina, really close to Black Mountain. Which is certainly another inspiration of mine, Black Mountain College and Charles Olson and the whole idea of creating communities where people can really create art and live in a way that isn't really acknowledged by our culture. But fast forward, you know, I started to feel like the rhetoric when I studied permaculture in the 90s by my teachers was how you do permaculture, which is something Larry Santoyo makes fun of, which is you don't do permaculture. Permaculture is a process. It's not something that you do. And it is an important distinction because a classic misconception is that permaculture is herb spirals, chicken tractors, no-till mulch gardening, and composting toilets and earth ships, right? Well, arguably permaculture is none of those things. What it actually is it's a process of designing. And you can design your life, you can design your apartment, you can design a city, you can design a watershed with permaculture. It's just site analysis, assessment, ecological planning. So what drew me to it is that I'd been studying things like ancient history. I'd done stuff, unique experiences of mine were back in high school. I actually traveled with gypsies for 2.5 months because I went to the free school that I taught at for 10 years. So I had a unique educational experience where I had tutors. I was supported to do things like go to Greece for 2.5 months and travel in horse-drawn carts and visit a lot of the ancient sites in the southern Peloponnese of Greece in 10th grade. And that kind of thing changed my understanding of what you really need to do well, which is what I think as a culture, as individuals, we've often lost sight of what's reasonable. What do we really need? Like, what I mean by that is that I learned in that camping environment that we could cook all the food for 13 people every single day, 3 meals a day over a campfire. No problem. we could live outside, camping outside. So in 96, I study permaculture design to farm. I was midway through my career teaching at Apatinas. So I taught there for 10 years from 91 to about 2001. So I brought it back to Apatinas because they actually paid for half of my class as staff enrichment. It's a K through 12 school of 100 children run through the consensus process, amalgamated with Robert's Rules of Order. Really unique thing about Apatinas, it closed after 43 years of operation. That's not the unique thing. But the unique thing is that they gave out a state certified high school diploma, but they had no grades, just credit and self-directed educational programming with classes that we created as staff there that satisfied Carnegie Learning Units and what the state needed to see for 4 English, 3 Science, 3 Math, 3 Social Studies, right, half right. a PE, right? So I learned all how you make permaculture look like and more than look like it, adequately satisfy what the state is looking for in a social studies class, what they're looking for in a science class, right? So I taught an environmental chemistry class there after bringing permaculture back, where the assignment for the students was to go research their nearest stream or the nearest Superfund site to their house. And I still use that as a design assignment for my permaculture class that I'm teaching right now online, which now the number on that is more like 700 graduates. That bio is a little bit dated.
Updated.
You know, and arguably one of the claims to fame that we have, I would say, to fast forward, is the design certification program that we've been running in Manhattan and Brooklyn for more than 13 years with over 600 people taking a 72-hour course with us. I mean, it's a substantial business enterprise as an entrepreneur to actually run freelance educational programs independent of any institution that is entirely just filled by my own material, because people see our videos, because people hear a public talk I give, because I'm passionate about changing the world in a way that's relevant to a lot of people. And how that happened is because of my vision of creating change through education, that I see education as a vastly underutilized tool for social transformation. And I'm deeply unimpressed with the majority of things that people are doing in these places that we call school. I'm glad for them to take care of our children and create an advanced daycare service. But do I really think that the majority of what people are studying in these academic institutions ends us up with a world that's a better place for future generations to inherit? I would posit to you that if we ask that question of our educational system, we'll see it's a dismal failure.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we have to ask hard questions about is, are we involved in a band-aid set of activities that are actually still part of a slow death process that we're in when we do things like think we can just continue with business as usual, but put up 20 megawatt solar farms on prime agricultural soils? There's a real misconception happening in the renewable energy initiative thinking right now, for instance, where there's an equation being made that is not a true equation. And that equation is that if you build huge mega renewable arrays, you will then eliminate our reliance on fossil fuels. But what that formula is mistaking is the fact that we actually could cut down on the need to use energy by 50% just through investing an eighth of the money we spend right now on energy in efficiency measures, 1/8. This is according to Amory Lovins, a consultant for the Pentagon, a consultant for Boeing, a consultant for Walmart. This guy is saying, look, if you look at the 1970s, you'll see that the cheapest barrel of oil is the one you never bought. And you'll see that all we need to do is spend 1/8 of what we spend right now on energy services, on efficiency measures, and we'll actually cut down on our energy use by 50%. And when we're not looking at the ability to ultimately systemically retrofit what is a flawed system, even if we just look at what the independent system operators say, who are a consortium of Con Ed and Central Hudson and every single utility in the Northeast gets together and talks about how they think the grid should be designed. And they call it the ISO Operator's Manual, Independent System Operator's Manual. And so, you know, years back when Hurricane Sandy and Irene hit, I was invited to New School panels to talk about what does it look like to retrofit New York City in a way that makes sense, considering what just happened with the hurricane, right? What's really interesting is very few people think the way I do about problems like this. Most of the thinking that you're going to come across is end of the pipe, band-aid, industrialist, high-end design done by engineering firms who have no idea what an ecological solution would look like, which actually involves a good old axiom that's one of my favorites. It's called an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? And as a society, we are woefully underappreciative of what that axiom is telling us. Because what it's saying is instead of throwing more band-aids on what is an utterly flawed system, you need to redesign the entire system. And you need to do that incrementally on a block-by-block basis in New York City, on a borough-by-borough basis, on a city by region basis. You don't just do it sort of like one backyard at a time through permaculture classes, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, the ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. I think, you know, most of our systems in our society are designed that way. I mean, you know, look at our food system, right? You know, just an ounce of prevention, you know, what people eat, you know, is much would be so much better,
but also
keep people healthy than to put the band-aids on with the pills and the medicine.
But then the next layer to ask about food is where does it come from and how was it grown? So that as we shorten the distance from which our food supply comes, we improve the quality and we improve the nutritional value and we improve the equity. So if you want to solve environmental issues, if you want to solve racial justice issues, if you want to solve pollution issues, the only way to actually solve them is a comprehensive redesign of the entire infrastructure.
Right.
And everything that right now perpetuates a centralized power grid by being grid tied in its nature is an end of the pipe band-aid application of renewable technologies. And the reason why you're seeing that be rolled out is because the cronies who run the planning boards and run the decision-making still are buddies with people who are industrialist contractors. And what we do not have is a society that says all of the community colleges should be training people up in something other than HVAC, geothermal, and grid-tied solar that they're calling green. Nonsense. Those things are the most ridiculously industrial solution to what could be done with so much more finesse, elegance, and appropriateness. But we live in a culture where we've woefully undereducated our civilian sector in how to do this new system, right? And we lack political will to get behind the educational initiative that it's going to take to create a vocational program that trains up the builders, the contractors, the designers, and the engineers to do the new infrastructure. Because right now what we have is a well-funded, poorly designed industrial behemoth being kept alive by people whose mentality is stuck in that framework. And their concept of what they're pitching to us, the environmental sector, as the way to solve the fossil fuel issue is a half-baked crony concept of what we really need. And it's sad how many groups I see who have swallowed the pill of it and then gone out as aggressive, rabid advocates of the new green infrastructure because it's the only way we're going to all keep going down from climate change. Right. Mm-hmm. So now we're
I want to back you, Andrew, I want to back you up just a little bit because I think there might be some listeners that actually don't really even understand the difference between permaculture and, let's say, just, you know, someone saying, or, you know, their farm's organic or sustainable.
Right. That's a great question. Let me say, what permaculture really is way more than gardening, which is why I'm talking about all these things that might
exactly.
seem to you.
Yeah.
If you thought when you chimed in that you were going to hear an interview with a permaculture guy and he was just going to talk about heirloom carrots and which ones
right.
are the best.
Right.
I know a lot about that. I teach people all about that. But let me say that what's compelling about permaculture is that it's not just about growing carrots. I love biodynamics. I like biointensive. I like organic. I like no-till. I like all kinds of gardening techniques. But what permaculture is it's about redesigning the entire infrastructure. And it's about redesigning not only the food system to not be an industrial nightmare that's leaving a toxic legacy and exploiting people all over the planet, but it's also about resuscitating the energy system. It's about dealing with wastes in a way that's thoughtful, comprehensive, preventative. It's about borrowing good ideas from all over the world that we know are already working them and fast-tracking them here. Because permaculture is a design-oriented solution set that is focused on retrofitting the industrial infrastructure to be more localized, to be more ecological, to be more socially just and responsible. We take the triple bottom line of sustainable economics, which is ecology, economy, society. And we land them geographically in designing the structures that can actually meet that type of ethical framework. How do we design things to actually improve the ecological health of the world, improve the social well-being of all of us, and create prosperity for future generations to inherit? Because right now we live in a dismally unadvanced civilization that instead of improving ecological health, instead of improving social well-being, instead of leaving a planet that's in better shape than we were handed it, we are contaminating the planet, we are creating higher exploitation and concentration of wealth, and we are doing things in a way that by no means is actually leaving a better situation for anybody. So permaculture is like this analytical tool by which we look into the past and we say, what are the mistakes of previous eras in human history? And then we look into the future and we say, what are the good ideas that we want to glean from the past that worked? And what ones do we need to jettison and leave behind because they were disastrously destructive?
Mm-hmm.
So it's this good. This is very like, let's ask the big picture questions. We're a species on a planet in outer space where there are quantifiable constraints to existence. You know, the Earth's 24,901 miles in circumference, 70% ocean. I often say the ocean's the big thing looking us in the eye that we're really not talking enough about. You know, when you think about what right now, if we collectively got our behavior together, which is the big question for us, right? The big question is, how do we collectively get our behavior together? It's about like what Donella Meadows and people who have really looked at systems and how do you change a system? They'll tell you that the most effective leverage point for change is human values and human perceptions. And if you can change those, you can change a lot of other things that until those change, arguably, will not be able to be very effectively changed, right? So what permaculture does is it says, let's borrow great ideas from tons of other people that aren't even associated with this thing called permaculture. And then let's use it as a kind of umbrella framework to tie them all together and give people a toolkit that is accessible to the average person, but really feels quite advanced and intimidating when they first step towards it. They're like, wow, do I have the skills to do this? I don't know anything about architecture and gardening and building, and all these people in permaculture seem. So a lot of people who just encounter it from the outside first are like very impressed by the level of general skill set that that community encourages you to develop, right? So it's like a very DIYer community. They're very into praxis. What drew me to permaculture is that it's a combination of theory with practice. And they're very clear about the fact that you can't know what you're doing in this field unless you go through an iterative life process of cooking up ideas and then trying them out and seeing what worked, what didn't work, then cooking up your ideas again and then trying them out. But if you're not ever doing the trying them out part, you're not doing permaculture in the true grit term that the term applies to when you actually say, I want to do this as a practice. as a discipline, as something I offer a consultation service in, which I also have quite a robust program now when it comes to the amount, you know, with COVID and the exodus out of New York City, because, you know, so part of my story was that I realized after taking kids to Camp Hill Villages to study biodynamics, you know, and to go into a little background there, you know, why I felt learning biodynamics, Rudolf Steiner, 1924, channeling things from the astral plane and coming up with this concept that then a lot of people after him, Aaron Fried Pfeiffer, Maria Thun, a lot of people after Steiner are really responsible for what we now call biodynamic farming and gardening. But definitely Steiner in 24 with the 8 agriculture lectures is the foundation of biodynamics, right? So you have a couple of things going on with BD. That's shorthand for biodynamics. BD predates permaculture, right? It's 1924. Permaculture is 1970s. What is different about them is a lot. But one of the main things that you heard me say earlier is that biodynamics is largely about gardening and farming. There's a lot more to it as far as the details, but generally speaking, permaculture is unique in that it's saying we need to transform our entire civilization to not repeat the mistakes of past civilizations. So there's this whole part of permaculture that gets into the material that you'll probably, if you know this type of writing, you know, people like Daniel Quinn, people who are writing about ancient civilizations and ancient cultures and talking about what are the patterns of civilization. That's part of permaculture. But then it's also this idea that industrial farming and industrial society in general is hazardous to all life as we know it and needs to be shut down and turned around. And how are we going to do that? This is the part that's so compelling about permaculture. It's saying, how are we going to do that? We're not just going to kvetch to the end of the day about how awful the system is. We're going to do that. We're going to vigilantly resist getting killed by it prematurely. And we're going to shut it down by creating a better system right in the midst of it that's so attractive, right? They're sort of like a Western salesman in that sense. Permaculture's like, what we're going to do is we're just going to make something that's so much better. And here's an example of that. Organic food in the United States, CSAs in the Northeastern Corridor. There are so many market indicators, even in our dismal market framework, because I wouldn't suggest that we should judge whether a phenomenon is viable just by whether this economy supports it, because that's a long shot, right? But it is interesting when ideas get that level of cross confirmation, right? It's clear that what permaculture is saying is true, because at the foundation, the growth of organic food sales in the United States is an indicator of the philosophical positioning that permaculture suggests is a good one, which is you can bump up your head against the wall of the system and say how angry you are and how wrong it is, and you're going to get frustrated, burned out, and bruised, whereas you can then turn around from trying to break down the wall and just create a new system that displaces it completely. And what that looks like in permaculture is a fun mnemonic that we use. We call it local livelihoods for local people from local landscapes. And the reason why we're keen on that idea is that we're saying another unique thing is in the United States, you'll find that the conservation movement, which I've done a lot of work for watershed groups, restoration ecology groups, I've taken school kids out to plant native trees along eroded stream banks. I'm big into that kind of stuff. But what I have seen when I get close to that population is they don't think at all about feeding people or interplanting their reforestation projects with things that you could build a house out of. They don't think about a fuel wood lumber lot, none of that. All they think about is Tweety birds, which is great. We need habitat for Tweety birds, but you know what else? When we're planting out forests all over a township in its stream corridors, we could also be making it a little wider and planting something that we get a harvest from in a sustainable way, right? And what we have in the United States is this notion that you either conserve and protect land and do nothing with it and never get a harvest from it, or you decimate it with industrial clear cutting. It's like, you know, there's actually a middle ground. And that's what organic farming has shown us. And now we've got people like Michael Pollan helping us wise up as a society to the fact that organic is actually getting capitalized on by Archer Daniels Midland and the agribusiness sector. And that's why you have such exploitative, unethical, unhygienic conditions going on out in California for poor people coming here from other countries who end up growing our high-end organic lettuce in the, you know, southwestern desert. The reason why that is happening is not because it makes the most financial sense. It's because the small business enterprise sector in the Northeast, where a lot of that demand is coming from, isn't stepping up to the demand. So right now, supply, Glenwood Institute, Rockefeller Foundation funded analyst of what's going on with Hudson Valley Regional Food Supply says that demand right now outstrips supply annually by over $650 million, right? So what Glenwood is saying is, well, we sell about $150 million annually in the tri-state area of local produce, but demand is really more like $800 million. So what you end up with is those dollars and cents of that buying base that, and let me tell you, this is the kind of thing that I go on about so much because we need to feel that these ideas are both not inaccessible, see the examples that are right here in our midst, and then get a sense of where we're trying to go with this. Right. That's the point of this kind of
thinking. With in the Northeast, you know, we don't have the climate where we can grow lettuce year round, you know, and vegetables year round, like you can do in California. So how
That's actually not completely true, especially if you looked at New York City and you maxed out what one operation, you know, Gotham Greens is easily making several hundred thousand dollars a year off of one little greenhouse that then Whole Foods and Gowanus Canal contracted them to build a exact same version of. And if you started to say, all right, let's tax incentivize greenhouses on every roof that we know with no improvements has the load bearing capacity to have a small rooftop farm on it. And let's send all the waste heat pipes from all of those buildings into all of those rooftop greenhouses to supplement their yield and take into consideration the fact that New York City is a grown, it's a seven. New York City is a growing zone seven. Do you know what Florida is? It's a 10. So seven is quite high. You go up here, sure, you're right. You get into zone six immediately. You're into zone six. You're into zone five when you get to Troy, when you get to Albany, right? So all of a sudden, we've just dropped two growing zones. What do USDA growing zones tell us? The number of months out of the year that there is absolutely going to be no frost, right? So the only months you even might see frost is like, you know, at the most 3 to 4 months out of the year in New York City. So you'd actually be surprised. Here's to give you, where's the ceiling on this? Shanghai has 15 million people. 15% of the population works growing food for people. They grow 60% of the Shanghai's population vegetable consumption. 4,000 tons a day they generate. That's how much the para-urban area around Shanghai is producing, 60% of the vegetable needs right now. Entire vegetable needs. That's not just lettuce, right? So you start to say, all right, as a planning goal, what does it look like to have a Greenbelt initiative around New York City, around Boston, around Philadelphia, where we tax incentivize agroecological farming that also has a tourist destination dimension to it? This is what they're doing around Stockholm. It's what they're doing around Amsterdam. It's what they're doing around Berlin. What are we doing in this country? Nothing when it comes to proactive, comprehensive, large-scale retrofit of our landscape and our food system and our infrastructure. And so what I see happening around a lot of this well-intended desire to transition to a green economy is misguided half-steps that end up repeating and justifying business as usual. You know, 90% of our food right now in the Northeast does not come from where we live. This is according to study after study, right? So maybe 10%. Whereas in Shanghai, 60% of their veggies is coming from within the city itself. That's 15 million people, 4,000 tons a day, right? You know, and you start saying, all right, what's going on in this country? So there's a bunch of things that I've been getting my own skills in. You know, when I went and decided to live off the grid in West Virginia, it was because what I had seen at the biodynamic orchard, what I had seen at the Quaker Guy's earth berm passive solar house, what I had seen doing reforestation for the township, none of it was a compilation of all the things I'd learned about when I studied permaculture at the farm with Peter Bain, Chuck Marsh, and Patricia Allison. What those folks did was went off and created their microcosm, which was Earth Haven. And back in the 90s, when I studied it, the rhetoric in the permaculture community was, when you practice permaculture, you build eco-villages and you help people find intentional communities and eco-villages and organic farms, and they can just go live in that world. But as I looked at that more, and having been somebody who had a close, you know, having had my dad die of cancer, I actually had a lot more skepticism about the rationality in that, because I started to do a broader analysis of pollution. And it's become really clear to me that pollution is so widespread and systemic that it is delusional to be some ostrich who sticks their head in the sand of some little eco-village and thinks that you're not going to get contaminated by strontium 90, other radioactive isotopes, DDT, PCBs. You know, if you live within a quarter mile of the Hudson River, this is according to the lawyers who won the class action suit against General Electric. Those lawyers, when they researched what was going on with environmental health issues in the Hudson Corridor, they said on a WAMC radio interview, very clearly, they said, if you live within a quarter mile of the main stem of the Hudson downstream from Schenectady, where General Electric dumped the PCBs into it, if you live within a quarter mile of the main stream, you are getting exposed to an inordinately high level of an aerosolized form of polychlorinated biphenyls. And you are in a corridor where you are measurably more likely to contract cancer because of it. Now, check this one out. The National Institute of Health estimates that if you live within the quarter mile of a high tension line, that's any domicile within a quarter mile of a high tension line, has a measurably higher incidence of leukemia and an array of immunodeficiency-related diseases. This is according to the National Institute of Health on a 30-year study. They went further and said, if we improved air quality by 30% in the Northeastern Corridor, we would save 4,000 people a year from dying from air pollution. But that still wouldn't be bringing it to what the Clean Air Act says it should be. So to me, here's the short version of what I'm getting at. One, the permaculture community has often been a little bit immature in its ability to wake up to how truly widespread the issues are that we're wanting to grapple with. And therefore, it has also underprepared itself for scaled up master planning design contributions. What it has done a good job of is powering up a DIYer crowd to get more success in their homesteading and their gardening and their farming. There is a lot of the United States population that are not do-it-yourselfers. A lot. And if you want to bring this to the people, you need to start a business that provides it as a service. Because why are people hiring landscapers who use noxious, toxic, gas-spewing yard equipment when there are lots of like quiet hand tool versions, electric versions? There's lots of ways, organic versions. Why aren't people in New Jersey, Bergen County, hiring everybody to do organic lawn care, even though they've had lots of policymakers tell them they should? Because there's nobody offering an organic lawn care landscaping service, right? So you've got these, you've got this kind of disconnect thing happening in the U.S. where we've put so much energy into guilt tripping people in the environmental sector that we've really primed them to be a good buying base for more ethically minded and ecologically minded products and services. But the reality is, the entrepreneurial business sector hasn't stepped up to meet the demand that the environmental sector has actually driven. Right? That's how I look at it from a market viewpoint. It's very interesting to realize that my goal with being an educator in New York City is to power up, train up adults who are ready to career shift to meet this demand in ways that they find enjoyable and meaningful, right? So it's about educating adults who are often like master's degrees, PhDs, they work at an architectural firm, and then they're like, and now what? And then they come take permaculture with us. Because our class is like, it's really interesting the gamut we have. You know, we have people who are like, just got out of undergraduate college and are just asking questions about society. And then we have people who are in their 60s and retired in Long Island and own a family property. And then we have people who are in their, a lot of them are more like 30s to 50s, and they're people who maybe already had a career in the public education sector or in the architectural field. They have an engineering degree. Most of my students have much more advanced degrees than I do, right? I have an undergraduate degree, but what do I have? A vast amount of life experience that they don't have. And that becomes evident when you spend time in a room with somebody and you start talking shop about life and projects and how do we create change, you know? My goal is to be an effective communicator about transforming issues that are deep-rooted issues in our society that need to be addressed and that we've been addressing in ways that are radical, forward-thinking, and have possibly alienated people over time in a way that now I feel we have an audience that is more ready for the kind of deconstructionist analysis that we bring to a system that now we are in an atmosphere culturally where there is less of an apologist posture going on. Less
it
of
seems
this,
to me, right? It seems to me like we really have to, I mean, the changes have to be so big that and we need some political will. To actually make the policy changes, because I've also been on this path for so long, and I really see that, you know, for change to really take place, people aren't just willingly taking it up themselves. There needs to be policy and incentives to.
Yeah, absolutely. I see it as a both and. But if I had to say where are we putting our effort as educators, Adriana and I in the Center for Bioregional Living and the work we've been doing, has really been focused on creating examples that people can understand of what an alternative looks like. So that you can, in other words, we've been focusing on grassroots education and empowering up a broad cross-section of the population to understand how to articulate a set of design solutions that truly will systemically solve many of the problems that we often are just hearing end of the pipe concepts about how to address them, right? And what I mean by this is that I think it's very important that we focus on policy. I think it's very important that we focus on anything and everything that we feel we can do and are inspired to do when it comes to advocating for what we would rather see in the world. What's a better way for us to be together as humans on this planet and together with each other? Can we be more caring? Can we be more conscientious? There's lots of work to do, right? We need to choose our battles wisely. We need to be intentional about our energy and what we're doing with it. We need to heal ourselves, drink lots of good water, breathe a lot, don't look at the computer too much, you know, right? So we need to have self-care. We need to trust ourselves. We need to love ourselves, really, to do well in the world. And that's all part of the work, as well as doing stuff, right? We're in a society that has, you know, really beaten us up as individuals into thinking we always have to be proving ourselves. We always have to be doing something. And that can be detrimental to our health and our well-being, because often less is more when it comes to health, right? It's like, it's not always about the doing. It's not always about a better exercise regimen or a better this or a lot of times we need to just sit and just breathe and just be and just watch the clouds float by in the sky. You know, it's so I think there's so many layers of healing that we want to be tuned into when it comes to doing positive work in the world. And what arguably what might be some of the most important work is to not beat ourselves up and feel neurotic or hamstrung by our idealism. To be careful of idealism kind of steamrolling your mental health.
You know, that's you know, but for my listeners, for instance, who want to be actively engaged in trying to move the needle towards a more systemically permacultural way.
Yeah.
What do you suggest people do to get involved to do that? Great, I mean, because we all can, and we only have like 2 minutes for you to answer that.
Okay,
we're just about out of time. So
let me say one of the big things I think is like watersheds and watershed master planning, right? So I think and coming up with the designs, you know, like here's a retrofit design we did for Ellenville, where we suggested to the Village of Ellenville and the Office of Economic Development for the County of Ulster, how we could do things like go more food independent. You know, the Rondout watershed, I've done numbers on this, but the Rondout watershed is 91,500 people. What is the Rondout? The Rondout is Kingston. It is Kerhonkson. It is Ellenville. That's the Rondout watershed. So you got 91,500 people there. Well, there's well over 300,000 acres of land. And according to calculations done out at a very recent food study from University of New Hampshire, it really only takes about 2 acres to grow full diet year-round food supply. So part of what I'm saying is we want to advocate for ideas like, what does it look like for the city of New York to go more food independent, to enforce the Clean Air Act, and to incentivize green infrastructure development where we have a positive land use pattern happening in high density urban areas and in outlying suburban and country areas. And we create regional master plans that as community members, we begin to advocate for this type of planning. And where we feel we can, we cook up those plans for our town, for our neighborhood. Start with your house, start with your own property and come up with some design ideas about how more your food, how you can compost full diet, how you can begin to produce some of your needs in a way that's low tech. Could you cook outside more in the summertime with a passive solar oven? Are there ways that you can begin to disconnect from fossil fuels by one of the simple systems we do is put in a lot of gravity fed rain tanks and use rainwater spring, summer, and fall for all of our farm uses and all of our outdoor garden needs. Mm-hmm. So I think the ways to do this are multiple, and the most accessible might be the personal ones in our own house with our own properties. But then what I would encourage folks to be inspired to consider is be an advocate for change at a town and a planning level and go to planning board meetings, get involved in your civic sector where you feel inclined to and begin to advocate for broader watershed planning and even just watershed literacy. I would say, well, it may seem simplistic, is actually very important. Talking in that type of language and design perspective connects things in a way that makes it a lot more real, because geographically it is a pattern that we all are living within that we want to begin to pay more attention to.
Right. So Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. You're a wealth of information, as you know, and
thank you.
Really
thank
inspiring. You. So I hope people, you know, check out your website for the Center for Bioregional Living and all the courses that you offer. I will share your links on my website. If you want to just quickly give people the website address or how they, do you want people to reach out to you personally?
Sure. Yeah, well, and the easiest way to do that is on our website, because you'll find there's a contact email that comes right into my email box. So rather than giving you two addresses, I find it to be easier to just say, drop me an email on my website and I'll get right back to you.
Great. So that's the permacultureNewYork.com.
Yeah.
And you'll find Andrew there. Thank you so much, Andrew. And thank you, everybody, for joining us this week.
Yeah.
You've been so awesome. Much. And I will see you all again next week.
Thank
Hopefully
you,
at the CSA fair too. Really? Bye. Thank you.